You ask me what I am, I'm a teacher. Yeah, I'm a professor. Yeah, I've done a lot of research and continue to do so, but fundamentally I'm a teacher. Of course, Sarah's comments about my involvement, I was one of the two co-chairs of a 27-member expert writing committee that produced a set of science standards for the State Board of Education in Kansas in the late 1990s. It wasn't a lot of fun for lots of reasons, but I'm not here to talk specifically about that. What I'm going to talk about is the whole conflict and the notion of defeating the teaching of creationism in the public science classroom. There's good news, or you may or may not think it's good news. I think it's good news, in that at least in federal court cases over the past 40 years, the advocates of teaching evolution have been victorious in every one of the major court cases. Also, the treatment of evolution is increasingly better in terms of the state curriculum standards. It's gotten better over the years, and we've been through now the era of standards started in the early 1990s, and states have produced them, science organizations have produced them, and we're seeing next generations. Biological evolution is also one of four core disciplinary ideas in the brand new, just released framework for science, for K-12 science education that comes out of the National Research Council, which of course is the arm of the three national academies. The bad news is, at least again from my perspective, it may or may not be bad news for you, since there's a lot of variation, is that in U.S. classrooms, the advocates of evolution, scientific methods, since there is no single the scientific method, and even reason seem to be losing. The teaching of evolution is quite often non-existent or superficial or contaminated with all sorts of misinformation. And I would define misinformation as information that's not very consistent with what we know through modern science. Bad news continued. If you want to look at recent polls, majority want creationism taught in the schools, in the public schools. A plurality of this particular group wants creationism taught as science in science class. A lot of people view the national standards, both the first generation and the generation that's coming on, as very hostile toward their values. But there is a small but increasing number that prefers that we teach only evolution. Then those who take the middle position or some sort of in the middle of the distribution seem to be decreasing. All the quantitative details are in a relatively new book by Berkman and Pletzer, and I would suggest that it's good reading. Solving this problem requires all kinds of knowledge. In addition to subject matter knowledge is necessary. Without it, we couldn't do it. It's not sufficient. Knowledge of teachers in the process of teaching is necessary, and without it, we couldn't solve the problem. But it's not sufficient. Knowledge of learners and learning, and knowledge of the context and setting in which we work, and their variations in terms of which we work. I prepare teachers to work in the public and private schools, and that's very different than the college environment. What we need are teams of people and groups of people who can come together and work together and cover all of these knowledge bases, since every one of them is necessary and none of them alone is sufficient. Well, how did we get to this mess? And I'm going to exclude from when Darwin produced the book all the way up to the advent of intelligent design. I assume people are pretty well familiar with that. With the advent of intelligent design and the wedge strategy and our own willingness to, quote, sit on the sideline and do very little or anything about it is what I'm going to talk about a little bit. Here's intelligent design theory as described by one of its detractors, Eugenie Scott, who is affectionately known by many of us as the nation's firewoman. She's always going about the country trying to put out the fires in the conflicts. You came to Kansas several times when all this was going on. Universe is the product of a design process. Designer's intelligent. The products of ID and natural processes can be empirically distinguished. And one of them is irreducible complexity, which Michael Behe is a strong advocate of that. And the other one is complex specified information, the design inference by William Dembski. Giving equal time. This one comes from the Discovery Institute, and it's very similar in the sense it's a little bit more specific. Certain features of the universe and living things are best explained by an intelligent cause rather than by an undirected process. If we sense apparent design becomes genuine design, then that's the product of an intelligent cause. Again, complex specified information and eventually irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity is seen here as a form of the complex specified information argument. And if we find irreducible complexity, then we can reverse engineer some biological structures to determine if all parts of the structure are required for the function of that structure. If all are, then it's been designed. If it doesn't work, if we remove a part, then it's been designed. And that's from the Discovery Institute, which is a well-known advocate of ID. Well, the marketing of intelligent design has been a real interesting situation. Again, the background, and this comes from the Wedge Strategy, which is a document produced by Philip Johnson and supported very much by folks at the Discovery Institute. Again, the background is, as you see, I don't think that certainly wouldn't disagree with the first bullet. Certainly would agree that that the positions have been attacked by advocates of modern science. However, the consequences of that are depends on to whom you talk. Materialism in their view triumphed with the devastating consequences that we can see there. And I think we probably know all those, and so we'll move on. In terms of the strategy itself, it's a 5-year summary. Again, to defeat materialism by cutting off its principal source, which is scientific materialism, and to view materialistic science as a tree, and to drive a wedge into that tree at its weakest points. So it's a very effective strategy, and goes through 3 phases. And of course, this was developed back in the 1990s, and so they're well beyond their 5-year plan. And first phase is scientific research, writing, and publication. Second phase is publicity and opinion making. And the third phase is confrontation and renewal. And if you want to see any of these documents, you can. All you really have to do is go to the website at the Discovery Institute, and you can find your way in there. Well, how should advocates of science react? We've been largely sitting on the sidelines. There are isolated ones of us who do things. Eugenie Scott is obviously the leader at this, but others of us do things from time to time. The question is if we think something needs to be done because the situation is not in all that great a shape, then we need, I think, to think about coming together and trying to do things in a more coordinated manner. And one of them would be to design and carry out our own marketing strategy. Because the audience ought to be everybody. Now, we're not going to be successful with everybody, but that doesn't mean we should exclude anybody. I mean, people are free to make up their own minds. And that's something that we should respect. So the characteristics of the American audience at this point in time, from lots of data, from TIMSS, from PISA, and numerous state assessments, is that we're dealing with a large group of folks where the level of science literacy is relatively small. The vast majority, perhaps 8 or 9 out of 10, believe in God. Many of that group reject evolution. And again, the quantitative details are actually in lots of documents over the past 15 to 20 years, but Berkman and Plutzer have produced some new data, which I think are worth reading. What to do? Well, we never want to quit emphasizing evidence, but one of the problems with that from a teaching perspective is the most important factor in learning something new is what the student or learner already knows. That comes from David Auzebell from a few years back, 60s. I think I was still in high school then, at least the early 60s. And so, in many respects, we're in a position where if you start presenting scientific evidence for it all, you're immediately shut out and the group is turned off. I'm not saying don't do that. I'm saying we have to find some other ways to do some things. And I think that one of those is to use analogies. They've been used before. And usually analogies involve questions. And I see somebody chuckling in the back. It gets better. Somebody asked the rabbi, why is it the rabbis always answer a question with a question? I am not Jewish, but I taught high school kids chemistry at a school where in north suburban Indianapolis, Indiana, where 30 or 40% of the population was Jewish. At a great time with the kids and trying to understand them and them trying to understand me and talking about both chemistry, which is what I taught, as well as some religion. But the rabbi answered, "What's wrong with a question? What's wrong with a question?" Then there's this one rather well-known rabbi, I think known to all of us. He rarely responded to questions with any kind of a simple answer. Usually he asked a question or told a story, a metaphor, an analogy of some kind. He pushed his questioners to think for themselves, and he really pushed his disciple towards deeper levels of ambiguity and understanding what was going on and what he was trying to teach. It wasn't simple. So, rather than try to lay out a structure of an entire marketing thing, I'm going to focus on a few analogies that I have used over the course of time that seem to work well, and we'll prefer free to discuss them. First one is Indiana University, my alma mater, is not going to win the Big Ten Conference football championship in 2011, which the season starts in about a month. IU is not going to win it because Purdue is going to win it. Ah! You skeptic, you. What's wrong with this? Thank you. It ignores Nebraska because if somebody didn't say Nebraska, I was going to say Nebraska because I've got my cell phone turned off because my older daughter is a Nebraska graduate. She's married to a Nebraska graduate. He's a police officer. And if he's not on the way to arrest me at this point in time, I got my cell phone shut off. She's getting ready to call me and say, "Daddy, no, Nebraska is going to win it." And lots of the media think so. It's a false dichotomy. There are other solutions to this question. Wisconsin might even be in it. Hey, all right, go Badgers. Ohio State? Well, maybe. Their chances are diminished a little bit. Penn State. I would say that's right. There are 12 possibilities to win it. Okay. Next one, everybody in Illinois, no, we're in Illinois, we better be nice to them, plus I spent 10 years in Chicago. Another analogy centers around the question, is science atheistic? So I've got some questions for you. Here's the first one. Did you seriously consider your personal religious views in deciding where to sit in this room today to hear these talks? If you did, hold up your hand. Okay. You are excluded from the next question. None of the rest of you did. And I'm assuming in this group that everybody holds some kind of religious view other than atheism or even agnosticism. If not, if you didn't do that, then I would say that you employed some very simple empirical methods, basically associated with methodological naturalism in making that decision. My former doctoral student is going to talk right after I get done, and I said, he was wondering when I was sitting in the back. I've always sat in the back of the room as a student because I wanted to hide behind the big guy in front of me so that professor couldn't see me or the teacher, so because I didn't want to talk when I was a kid. And I still have that habit. You may have decided you wanted to sit in the back of the room so you could doze off if the presentation got boring or something. There are lots of reasons for that, as long as you didn't use your personal religious views. Because you didn't use them, hold up your hand if you feel you rejected them. Nobody has ever held up his or her hand to that. And I cannot tell you how many times I've asked groups this question. In a lot more difficult groups than this one is. No one has ever held up his or her hand to that. I think not too. And so therefore, the claim that gets made by a lot of folks that methodological naturalism is a provisional kind of atheism simply doesn't hold up. Again, that you can be a scientist or a science teacher and use science and sleep comfortably as a believer, because the two are not in conflict. How many of you have ever stood in a line? Hold up your hand. First question. When somebody cut in line, what did you think? Get those hands up. I am interactive. What did you think? They must be French, all right. I'll go for that one. Why French? Why? Okay. Somebody else. Okay. What did you say? Who said something? The line starts there. He's pointing back. Okay. What did you do? Hopefully, you didn't do much. I mean, in not in polite society. Regarding the position of intelligent design theory in the pre-college science curriculum, meaning the public school curriculum, if ID is ever going to make it there, and that's an open question, it first has to become legitimate, sound, respectable science. It is not at this point in time. I'll leave the door open that maybe it could be, although the whole concept of design says it's more of an engineering process than a science process, and then the supporters must answer the question. Who is the designer? In fact, they do answer that question all the time when they go to churches and places, and they're very open about it. The designer is the one we know. It's God. But they don't answer it in public places and in situations where it's important not to answer that. And until they get their act together and prove the scientific and or engineering merit, and there are some Other things that happen, ID is cutting in line. Well, it's only fair to teach the strengths and weaknesses of evolution. It's only fair. This is America. It's fair. Well, if science teachers are using guided inquiry or some form of inquiry as an instructional method and teaching toward the content standards, which means the important concepts themselves, the content, and also teaching the nature of science and nature of scientific inquiry and nature of science, they're already doing this, except it's not called strengths and weaknesses. It's simply what we know through science, this nature of scientific knowledge, how we have come to that by scientific methods, since geologists and archaeologists tend to do their work in a slightly different scientific context and reasoning and situations than, say, physicists do and chemists do quite a bit. And so, if you're a science teacher or a science teacher who is employing inquiry strategies and teaching nature of science, which is a very broad spectrum, and nature of scientific knowledge, they're already doing this. Unfortunately, there is way too much emphasis on teaching science as a reading subject, or teaching science and or teaching science as the rhetoric of its conclusions. We're famous for that at the college level. You're going to like this one. Consider an open pot of boiling water. Dennis is going to like this. Several explanations. One of them would be that the vapor pressure of the water equals the atmospheric pressure above the water. Is that one okay? Was when I taught high school kids chemistry. I don't think it's changed since then. It's also okay to say, I think, that the water molecules are moving fast enough. They got enough energy that the water's starting to boil. Well, there was enough heat applied from the burner down below the stove, in the stove, that it's boiling. Or, I just wanted some tea. All these are correct. None of them contradict any of the others. And it's from John Hott, Dennis. I got 30 seconds left. So we'll go to two experts. And again, John Paul II sees no problem. And that's not surprising. This next one may be a bit more surprising. The Reverend Mr. Graham doesn't see a problem either. Questions? Yeah. Social studies. Yeah, I think you have to. History or social studies or even classes on religion, even in the public schools. I don't see anything wrong. Now, I'm not a court justice, but I don't personally see anything illegal with teaching a survey of religion in the public schools, at the high school level. A few schools do. I think isolated places do. Places that are large enough that have a huge student body. The place I taught at, North Central High School in suburban Indianapolis, I'm not sure whether they are at the moment, but they, with graduating classes of 1,300, which is huge. Places in suburban Chicago like New Trier, I don't know. The possibilities exist there simply because there's a large enough student body and a broad enough faculty to have lots of different. There are also college prep places, so that might be. I think it's. I don't see it as being a violation of the law, but then I'm not a justice. Yes. People like me who are believers and also science advocates who don't see a conflict between the two, but are skeptical of the latest evolved form of creationism, which is intelligent design. Then we want to hear your case. I'm open to hearing anything. The question is whether we're going to let young, impressionable minds hear it. I'm a big guy. On what? That's the latest... strategy from the group. First of all, academic freedom is a concept that first got applied at the college level and was never really a part of the K-12 public education system and is becoming less a part of that under the influences of No Child Left Behind, regardless of how that gets worked out if it ever does get worked out. But right now, the public school education is, in my humble opinion, becoming more of a disaster area as we teach for the test and do those kinds of things. School teachers have never had much in the way of academic freedom, and it's even less at this point in time. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. I'm very concerned about that. These days I work with largely elementary teachers. One, because the problem starts there, and two, because I've found over the years that my own disposition as a teacher is much more aligned with that of elementary teachers. If you ask a high school teacher what he or she teaches, 99 times out of 100, you're going to get a subject matter. I teach chemistry. If I'm in a fairly nasty mood, I might ask this question: what kind of a grade did chemistry get this year? Yeah. And that is because chemistry didn't get a grade. The kids get the grades. Yeah.
Your friend Jeannie Scott is my boss. And on a microwave at the office, he said that this microwave operates on the principles of electromagnetism, which is only a theory. Therefore, it's illegal to operate this microwave again.
Right.
Many religious organizations which have incorporated evolutionary thinking along with gravity into their theology. And I wonder how many of the students that you teach aren't aware of the fact that their own denomination has already been through this and has already embraced an evolutionary view of the world.
A lot of them aren't. The way I would respond to that is to go back to the subject matter issue. I'm not a theologian. I'm not trained that way. I'm wandering through trying to understand and that sort of thing. But that would be a person or a subject matter specialist that we would have to add to the team. You gonna kick me off?
I'm gonna kick you off.
Okay.
But I will follow your comment up with the fact that the September issue.
Okay, I need to get it out of there. Okay,
you're gonna beat it. A year or two ago for the Presbyterian Association on Science, Technology, and Christian Faith, we had a whole issue devoted to illiteracy. The first was scientific and mathematical, the second one was biblical and theological, and the third one was.
Did I work this?